Angel. You don't need to know who I am, but you should know why I'm here. My grandpa, Stephen, is the author of a new exciting play called When the Break Happened in Orangeburg County. It's about our ancestors from when the break happened in 1865 until now. Many of my relatives are featured in the play, from my great-great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-grandpa Stephen to my grandpa Stephen. Guess what my uncle and cousin's name are? Stephen. Go to www.thebreakinorangeburg.com to learn more. An online store has been created to honor those relatives and other families with products featuring the Break logo. Go to www.thebreakstore.com to purchase items today and help to produce this play. Please!
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Show About Stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. I do certainly hope that you had a wonderfully productive week and that you are being careful and safe out there. This week, as my guest, I have three delightful, intelligent, wonderful women who are powerhouses for the last 50 years. Let me introduce them to you. Here is Sheila Frazier, Margaret Bushway, and Starletta Dubois. Welcome to you all. How are you all doing?
Good, Stephen. Good.
Now, two of you all are out in California. How's the weather out there?
Beautiful.
Beautiful. Oh. It's a milder winter than we've had. So it's not like hot like we're used to.
And Sheila is in
New York.
Now, first, I want to introduce you to Starletta and let Starletta tell you a little bit about herself and her career. She's a wonderful actress.
Hello. I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and grew up there and went to college, HBCU in Maryland State College at the time. It's University of Maryland Eastern Shore now. I started out at Harlem Hospital School of Nursing for 2 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And one of my professors, she saw that I was either in the morgue or in intensive care somewhere. But she said, wow, you have an aptitude in science, so why don't you go for it? While I was there, a wonderful woman, Marion Suger, would bring theater down to the school. And I started doing theater then. And when I did Ennui's Medea, The Hell Hath No Fury as a Woman Scorned, the light bulb went on, got my degree in biology, but quickly scurried to New York. I used to go back and forth to New York to take classes. And then I realized if I was really going to jump in the water, I needed to just jump. So, of course, the New Federal Theater, Henry Street Settlement under Woody King, did some stuff with the Negro Ensemble Company. So my stuff was a lot of on-the-job training. And there were so many places in New York you could study, which was wonderful. It was amazing. And I've been doing theater. I was blessed to be on Broadway in 79 in a beautiful play of Richard Wesley's called Mighty Gents, and was nominated for a Tony. Our play closed in 10 days.
Hey, let me interrupt you for just a minute and tell me, when you found out that you were nominated for a Tony, how did you feel at that moment?
First thing, I was shocked because I'm just getting out of the chute. And Ed Bullins, the playwright, told me I was gonna get nominated when we opened. And I'm saying, yeah, okay. But I was shocked and I was honored. I wore gardenias in my hair for Billie Holiday. And I remember giving another actress who was very nervous one of the flowers. I was just happy to be there. And that year it was amazing because Timbuktu, all sorts of things were nominated. And it was just a beautiful experience. Now I do plan to come back to Broadway. So this is not over. And so we'll see what happens. But theater is my first love, and I love doing TV and film.
Some of the things that you've been in.
The Sun, and The Notebook, Big Mama's House, Friday After Next.
Now, my younger audience finally will remember that.
Yeah, they'll remember Friday After Next, and they'll remember True to the Game. I play Gadget, I play Grandma, and a number of other things, TV things.
And you were in Never, the one about Michael Jackson?
Oh God, yes, the story I had to tell. They shaved my eyebrows to play his mom. So ladies, that wasn't a smart move because it's been taking me forever. And I'm still doing it. And I could do this till the wheels roll off. That's the good part.
Sheila?
You know what? I wish I could say that. Acting was my first love, but for me, I was a stutterer growing up. And so I never, ever thought that would ever happen to me. And the high school that I went to, there were so many talented people there, like Margaret Travolta. She was John Travolta's sister. She was like the queen of the stage. And I would just watch in awe. One day, Shaft had just come out, and a good friend of mine, Tony King, said, hey, listen, I'm going over to Richard's house. You know, I was with my cousin. The two of you want to go over with me and hang out?
Now, Richard who?
Richard Roundtree. Richard Roundtree. And so we went to Richard's house, and we were talking, and I was just like, oh my God, I had just seen Shaft. And so I was looking at a star. And I said, I always wanted to act, but I was saying it like, I always wanted to act. And so then he said, why don't you? And I said, no, you know, I'm thinking, can't you hear me? And so like he had his play and he had just come off the road doing The Great White Hope. And he said, read this. And I was reading it. Now when I read, I didn't stutter. And so he said, you should think about, since this is what you would love to do, joining the NEC. And I said, what is NEC? And so he said, the Negro Ensemble Company. He convinced me to make an appointment and go down. He says, you'll have to memorize a monologue and go down. And I don't know why I did it, because God knows I was scared to life to stand in front of anybody and speak. Anybody. Because when you stutter, you grow up with people laughing at you. So I made the appointment to come down. And so I had memorized it. I memorized James Weldon Johnson's Go Down Death. I know Star would be familiar with that. And did you know that when you audition at NEC, all of the teachers, they are sitting up and they're the ones scoring you. So I stood there. And when they said, okay, you may begin, the perspiration is just like running down my face. And I remember praying, God, let me have a heart attack so that way I have an excuse why I can't do this.
That was a bit extreme.
I wanted out. I was so scared. But something happened that I talk about it because it really is so unusual. I felt like I separated myself and I was standing on the side watching myself. They said, okay, you can begin now. And I started saying it. And I said it flawlessly. I could not understand how I did that. So they said that they would be in touch with me. And I realized later that what happens is that I gave myself permission to be somebody else. And overwhelming for me to get past this fear. And the only thing that drove me past the fear was to be somebody else. And so then I realized, okay, that's how it works. I joined NEC under Gil Moses.
Ooh.
Wasn't he awesome, Star? Yeah, so I joined under him. I studied under him. And about 5 months after that, I heard that Gordon Parks Jr. was doing a movie called Superfly. I was walking down Broadway and ran into Richard Roundtree and his manager. I said, listen, Richard, could you call and make it and see if I could get in on this audition? And he said, yeah, sure. And he and his manager called and got me an audition. They said, you just have to sit and wait because you got to come in last. So when I went there, I remember I crouched in the corner on the floor, just looking at everybody who was coming in, and Roz Cash, and then there were so many sisters were there that I had seen on television. And I'm thinking, okay, Richard said one thing to me, or maybe Bill Cherry did, his manager. He said, you got to go in there like it's yours, and no one else can do it. That's how you have to approach it. And so I did. I sat there till the very end, and then they called me in. And so I walked into the room and put my feet up on the desk.
You went from wanting to have a heart attack to putting your feet on the desk.
You don't have to look at anybody else because I'm the only one who can do this. And so they laughed. The producer was in the room at Gordon Parks. So Gordon said, I want to give you this script. He says, and your part is Georgia. I want you to memorize your lines and then come back tomorrow and read with Ron. I'm like, oh my God. Now I had just seen him down at Joe Papp's doing this play. And I would say, ooh, is that fine, man? And I was with my boyfriend at the time.
That gave him a lot of confidence.
So the idea that I was going to audition and read with him was just so far away from where I thought I would ever be. So when I came back, I not only memorized my lines, I memorized the script. And when I came in the next day, I knew Ron's lines, I knew my lines, I knew anybody close to my scene. I did it well, that I know. I knew Ron really liked me. Gordon said, this is yours. And I went home on cloud nine until I got a call from Gordon and he apologized. He said, I'm so sorry. He said, but the producer, he has a different idea of who the character is supposed to be. I'm sorry, Sheila, but listen, don't give up. Don't give up. Things change. And I'm like, hey, I have my number changed because I didn't want to hear anymore about that movie. 3 months later, on 59th Street, waiting for a photographer so I could do a new headshot. This guy walks up to me. He's like hitting on me. And I'm like, oh, God. So he says, I'm a producer. I'm like, oh, you know, his brother's tired. So he says, I am a producer. I said, but you, I said, what are you producing? And he says, I'm producing a movie called Superfly. And I said, you know what? I don't want to ever hear the name Superfly again. I'm not interested, but good for you. I don't want to hear about it. So he says, why? I said, long story. I don't want to hear about it. So he said, what's your name? So I told him my name. He said, man, we've been trying to find you for months. Your number is changed, is disconnected. We've been trying to find you for months. And I'm like, anyway, so he said, no, really, I promise you. So he said, if you give me your number, he says, I promise you, this is straight. And he says, they have really been looking for you. So sure enough, that night they called and the rest is history. I saw this was on a Tuesday and I shot that scene. I was so frightened of the idea of being nude. My mama didn't raise me that way. And so I met with Ron a few days before we shot and he cooked spaghetti and we laughed and talked about everything but that scene so that I was comfortable with him. And it was a closed set, of course. And I had the wardrobe lady there with a bathrobe so that when the suds went down, they had to made Gordon promise. Stop the cameras, let's film, let's sit up with suds again. Anyway, and the rest is history, as they say.
Let me tell you something in terms of that. You asked me when we first met.
Yes.
And I said that we met at the caucus. That's yeah. When I walked over to you and said to you, oh, I finally met you. I have been in love with you since that scene. The music just brought it out and it was just such a romantic scene. And look at the nudity. It was the scene. It was all together.
You didn't look at the nudity. What do you think about that?
You know what we say. We don't look at the Playboy for the pictures. We only look at it for the stories.
And that Brooklyn Bridge is waiting to be sold.
As your husband's behind you.
He's at another part of the house. But you know what, Stephen? I'm going to tell you what I hated about that scene. I hated it. At the premiere, that was my first time seeing the movie. And when they got to that scene, that was the longest scene. And they did it in slow motion. So my posterior was in slow motion. I was like, is this ever going to end?
Let me go to Margaret.
Yeah.
Margaret? Yes.
I can say that I don't have such an illustrious career as...
As I told you before, Bob Cambridge gave me the 911.
You mean the 411. Oh. I was a background person. My mom had me in plays when I was young, and I learned how to play the piano. As a matter of fact, I played tune and sang Shortening Bread on a Howdy Doody time cut to Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm born and raised. And I sang Shortening Bread when I was 3 years old. All my friends still remember me singing Shortening Bread. My mom wanted me to be a singer. She wanted me to be like Marian Anderson. But I wanted my voice to be like Nancy Wilson and Dionne Warwick. So I was in beauty contests. And if you're in a beauty contest, you have to have a talent. So my talent was singing. And I decided that was not what I really wanted to do. I wanted to travel the world. And the only way I could do that when I graduated from college was to go into the airlines. I went to TWA and I was based in New York. I saw all the second halves of every play that was on Broadway because I would go on my days off and stand outside the theater and wait until the intermission and everybody came out to have a cigarette. When they would go back in, I would follow the crowd in and I would stand around and wait to see if there was ever an empty seat. And I would sit in that seat and I saw the second half of all the plays. I was with a group of people one time and they were saying, we're gonna go and bowl with Sammy Davis Jr. And so I said, I wanna go. They said, come on and go with us. So I went to a bowling alley in New York, in Manhattan, and I was not noticed, but I was there. And I could bowl really good too, because we, growing up, that was the pastime for my family, to go to the bowling alley. Eventually I met Sammy when he was on one of my flights from New York to Los Angeles, and I was working first class, and he and his entourage were sitting in first class, and he wanted to know about me. And I told him that I had actually written my 12th grade book report on Yes, I Can. So I knew all about Sammy Davis Jr. And that was impressive to him. He said, I hope you got an A. I said, yes, I did. Long story short, I eventually ended up working with Sammy Davis Jr. And I was with his road company for 12 years in the 70s. And in those years, people like Sheila were doing things in Hollywood. I was an extra on movies like Cool Breeze and Hitman. I was a part of the group Bravo. Remember Bravo?
I remember.
We started that group, and we would do fundraisers and fashion shows and make money to help the indigent in Los Angeles. And then I started doing parties, and my parties were called People Who Make Things Happen. And I invited all of the people that I knew in the industry to come to these parties. And I would raise money for sickle cell anemia and the American Heart Association and the Cancer Society. And then those people that represented those organizations would come, and they were so impressed because I'd have all of the beautiful people in Los Angeles at my parties. And so that's how I got a reputation for knowing everybody and being the person to hook people up. And I coordinated weddings of those people that met at my parties and got married. So I've been doing things like that for a long time. But most recently, I've been working in the nonprofit arena and have a shelter for homeless female veterans in Los Angeles.
That is awesome.
What about, there's two things that you left out that I remember in terms of reading, is your being part of the dating game.
Yes, yes. When I returned to Los Angeles from working as a flight attendant, the club that everybody hung out was called Maverick's Flat. I went to Maverick's Flat when I was a teenager, when I was still in high school. And because they didn't sell liquor in Maverick's Flat in those days, it was just sodas that you could get from the bar. A guy by the name of Cassius Weathersby was there.
Oh my gosh.
Cassius said, Margaret, I want you to come do the dating game. I said, okay, I'll do the dating game. He was a recruiter. And I said, but I want a job like yours. I'm back from New York. I need a job. He says, let me introduce you to Chuck Barris. I went to the studio on Franklin and Vine, and I met Chuck Barris. He hired me immediately. And I worked as a talent coordinator. So I would go out to all the nightclubs, and I looked at handsome men, and would you like to do the dating game? Here's a contract. Come on and be there next week. So that was my job. And then I also would be on at the studio when the talent would come and sign the contracts and do all the paperwork that needed to be done. We would also chaperone the trips. Everybody that worked with Chuck Barris Productions was a chaperone. So I chaperoned people to Disneyland 100,000 times, and the Laguna Seca races, and Kentucky Derby, and trips to London and Italy. And the one trip that I took to Greece was when they were opening up a gambling casino in the Acropolis Hotel in Greece, in Athens. I was with Wilt Chamberlain and Elgin and Ruby Baylor and Eartha Kitt, and all these stars that were there. I was just the chaperone for the dating game, but we had a wonderful time. I lost the male part of the date that was on that trip. I had to call Chuck and say, what do I do? This guy hasn't shown back up. And he says, Margaret, you're leaving tomorrow. I would suggest you get the key to his room, pack his stuff up, and leave it at the front desk in his name. And I did. And to this day, we don't know what happened to Jason.
Were you on the show when Michael Jackson was on the show as a young boy?
I was not working there then. He did the show before I came on board.
Okay. The thing is that I know that you did a tour with Cecily Tyson.
I did. Yes. Cecily, actually, Bill Cosby called me up. He said, do you do weddings? I said, yeah. He said, come meet with Miles and Cecily. They're getting ready to get married, and they're getting married at my house, and Camille don't want to have nothing to do with it. He actually hired me to coordinate their wedding. And so we had several meetings, and we met at the La Scala restaurant one night, and I ordered a virgin pina colada, and Miles leaned over. He said, Mark, I said, that's a drink without liquor.
Shoot. I thought you was getting something special.
I did did put their wedding together. And shortly after that, she called and asked if I had my passport, which it had expired. I need you to go to Africa with me for 6 weeks. I went on a 6-week tour with Cecily Tyson as her publicist. The movie, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, had been released, and they were showing that in Africa. Then after the showing, then she would do a Q&A, and she would always do poems by Maya Angelou or Paul Laurence Dunbar. That was a fabulous opportunity for me to be there with her and to learn about her. We became like mother-daughter, sister kind of relationship, and maintained that relationship over the years.
What a wonderful story, wonderful story. Tell me, each of you all, I imagine, particularly in that time period where Black women wasn't doing much of anything before, and you all were at the cusp of this wave of Black women beginning to assert themselves, until now they're the Vice President of the United States, the soon to be president. How was it in terms of obstacles that you had to face, and how did you resolve some of the obstacles that you might have come upon? I'm gonna start with Starlight again, please.
Okay, well, can I tag it? Because I was blessed to work with Cicely.
Sure.
Definitely was a mentor, is a mentor. We did a beautiful film called Road to Galveston, and her doing Jane Pittman, and then the oldest Confederate widow tells all, they had to age her up. And in this movie, I played her 97-year-old blind girlfriend. So they had to do that. And she was so particular because she could see if the latex was peeling away that they used to age you. Mm-hmm. And she would stop the camera and just say, we can't break this fourth wall. Either she's aged up or she's not, okay? And you can't see it peeling away. She was so gracious and kind. And at the time I had just adopted my son, he was 5, and I took him to Texas with me. And whenever I've seen her since, she always talks to me and encourages me in terms of being a single mom in this business, because a lot of times you do have to put your work on hold to deal with family. And so I'll be forever grateful. And it's amazing because I had bought her book on Tuesday, got it Wednesday, and I was working on another project, and the young woman that was helping me with my research called to tell me she had passed. And it was like someone had punched me, did a solar plexus. I couldn't breathe for a minute. And I got myself together. And the beautiful thing that happened that night, she came to me in a dream. And I said, okay, because she always encouraged me. She said, do your best work. There'll be things that you may have to turn down because it won't organically flow out of you. Your gut knows when something is not right. And all of us can speak to that as artists. We know. I think she came by to tell me, baby girl, baby sister, you keep doing what you're doing. You've earned the respect. And that's how you should go going forward. Now, I want to get back to your question one more time.
Okay. Obstacles. Did you have any, and how were you resolving it?
He says, did I have any? I'm a woman of color. Say you're nominated for a Tony and you're a person of another ilk. You can come out to California and you'll end up with a series just with the nomination. As a person of color coming out, it was like, okay, what have you done lately, Dar? And in New York, we're such a family. We tell each other about auditions. We're rooting for each other.
That's right.
If you get the part, I'm happy for you, because when God says this has my name on it, I'm going to do mine. So it was never that competition as it is even here, even with women of color. So you have to navigate through all of that. And you're always an advocate for making sure what people are using your mouth to say, to speak through. And so I'm always careful, and I know in my gut when it doesn't feel right to me. And one of the things that I learned from Cicely, you may have to pass on things, and you have to trust enough that the gift that God has given you will make a way for you. So you can't be intimidated by agents who feel you should do X, Y, Z. Because when I came out here, I decided to go to school to get my master's. And they were saying, you're already working professionally. Why would you go? I said, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. Why wouldn't I learn as much as I could? And let me tell you what God did. We were on a quarter system. In between the quarter, God would allow me to book a job so I could stay in the game. And even when I made a choice not to go back to Broadway with the piano lesson because my dad got cancer and I went home for 2 years, that's supposed to be a death knell. You leave, you're forgotten about. He went into remission. I was able to do Fences with Ed Cambridge from NEC in Philly. And then a movie that had been put aside for a minute, Convicts, I was able to do with Robert Duvall and James Earl Jones. Okay, the FYI, James Earl Jones has been my husband and my father. Now y'all figure that out. But yes, there are obstacles. And even now, there are some. And one thing I just heard, because I'm supposed to be putting myself on tape for something, and my agent just said, you know what? You have earned your respect. Either they want to offer it to you, God has something else.
Sheila.
The one thing I was blessed with is I didn't get typecast. I did a lot of television roles and some film roles. Ron O'Neill and I did 3 films together. I did a lot of episodic things on television where I could play a doctor or a lawyer and different things. So that wasn't difficult for me. When Bill Cosby was doing California Suite, I was cast as his wife in that. So I did a nice cross section of work. But what started happening in the industry is that the roles were becoming disrespectful to we as a people. And so I had an issue with that. I remember that there was one movie where everybody was going up for it and we were sitting in the room. And so when you went in, some people came out smiling, some people did not. And when I went in and they explained the scene, the director, he was a well-known comedian and a director. And when he explained the like scene, I felt it was very disrespectful to us as a Black woman and my counterpart as a Black man. And so then I just said, thank you for like seeing me, but I'm not interested.
Good for you.
A fellow actress, a friend of mine, when she came out, she was still like smiling. I said, didn't it bother you? And so she says, no. She says, I got on my knees and I crawled over to the director and said, you've got to hire me. You've got to hire me. I said, you did what? God, I said, I'm tired. And also what helped out is that the industry is such you go through different, you know, time periods. When you're not an ingenue anymore and you're not old enough to be the mother, and the roles of mothers and children who are very scarce. I've always looked at the entertainment in industry as a business. I was never married to being an actor in front of the camera. During that time, I had a special events company. Nelson Mandela he had been freed and he was coming to the United States and he was coming to Los Angeles. Thank God for Maxine Waters, because originally it was predominantly all whites. Harry Belafonte was bringing him around, you know, the country, and Maxine Waters insisted, no, you're not coming to my city and there not be Black participation. My company was suggested, and I got the contract to make certain that there was Blacks represented there. So the tables were like 5,000, 10,000, 25,000, and 50,000. I got so many Black folks there at $10,000 and $25,000 tables. They showed up and showed out. It was a huge success. And what was so interesting is Danny and Alfred hosted it. And
now Danny who?
Danny Glover and Alfred Woods.
Oh, some people out there that might not know.
But just to show you how certain people are in the industry, how race plays a part in it, I was 100% driven that we would have representation. So the night of when they are reading the thank yous and such, my company was not on the program. My name was not on there at all. And Linda Cannon did this. She was so upset. She ran over to the stage and she called Danny over to her and told him what the issue was. So Danny made a speech and said, there's been a huge faux pas here. And I just want to say that Sheila Frazier's company, Sheila Frazier and Associates at that point, and so he spoke about what I did. But I learned that, like, one, don't be married to the spotlight. Be flexible. The entertainment business is just that. Go with the flow. After that, I did not want to do special events. That this wasn't something that I was excited about. You know, I kept saying, you know what, Lord, I want to get back in the entertainment field, Lord. I want to get back in the entertainment field. And I was at Reuben Cannon's house. His assistant, Cheryl Miller, was house washing while he and his wife went on vacation. And the telephone rings. And so I hear her say, yes, I know who Sheila Frazier is. Yes, she's right here. And so it turned out to be Bob Johnson's office, someone in his office saying, we're going to open up an office there in Los Angeles. And we need somebody who knows the Black talent, has a good relationship with them because we need the contacts. I had never produced anything in television. So I said, then I should be a producer then. And they said, whatever you want. And I said, yeah, okay. I said, I'd like to be a producer. Then I had to figure out what a producer did. I learned what a producer does. I said, I'm only going to be a BET for about 6 months and then I'm out of here. It turned out I was there for 13 years. And so I went from being an associate producer to the West Coast producer of a show called Screen Scene, that went actually behind the scenes of films and television. But also Bob Johnson had me train the people that he had hired as on-camera hosts. So I learned another skill. You know what? God uses everything that you have. There's nothing that just comes about. So when you're in the industry and you're flexible about doing whatever job that keeps the creative process going, star knows.
Yeah.
I want to say, you mentioned a name that I hadn't heard in a long time, Linda Cannon.
Yes, yes.
The manager of the Commodores, Benny Ashburn, was a great friend of mine. Yeah. So he called me up one day, and at the time I owned an advertising agency here in New York. And he said to me, a friend of mine is coming from Los Angeles to New York, and I need you to do me a favor. Take her around and let her look at the brownstones on Upper West Side. And that's what I did. I took her around to the different brownstones. It just made me remember those days.
But our families were so close because she and Reuben and the kids live just a few blocks away, that when it came to Thanksgiving and Christmas, Linda would go, just put your bathrobe over, and that's just what I would do. I put my bathrobe, I have my pajamas on, and my son and I, we would go over to the house, and so we all spent Thanksgiving together and Christmas together. It was a family affair. So yeah, she's funny.
Yes. I was, like I said before, kind of in the background, but as I'm sure
I keep telling you, Bob does not describe you as being in the background.
She was responsible for the background.
Okay, I was responsible for the background. And I'm sure that Sheila and Starletta can attest to the fact that being a single parent was the obstacle that we faced in this world of Hollywood. And I had my daughter, Sheila had her son, and Starletta had her son. And I always thought, before somebody asked me to do something, what am I going to do with my daughter? As she was growing up, I didn't want her really overexposed to the things that were happening in Hollywood. So I kept her in the family environment by having my mom and my sister and relatives, my village, help me with my child. And so those things that I did without her, when everybody would see me out and about, know that my child was being very well taken care of by members of my family. That was the only real obstacle that I could say I was faced with, because generally when I would go for something, I would get it.
And that's being in the background, right?
Exactly.
Can I say something? You know what? In our culture, we create a lot of aunts and uncles and cousins, so that I'm sure Margaret or like Star, you build that family, you know, of aunts and uncles who can help you out. That's the only way of getting through it.
I adopted in my 50s, which I look back, I'm trying to figure out how in the world.
But you're here.
But I'm saying only God. But I wanted to also, to Margaret, my mother was in show business, Princess Starletta Dupois, and had a dance partner, Toulet. This was before of you being with him. He was so gracious and kind, because at the old Savannah Club there in New York, down in the village, my mother had an accident and she was paralyzed. And Sammy did a benefit for her. So that enabled her to buy her home in Philadelphia, which was a three-story house. She was able to have a rooming house, so it would sustain her over the time she was here on this earth. So I would be forever grateful to him. And that whole family then of show business folks. That's the beauty of what we do. We are a family. We take care of each other. We make a way yes. for each other. I'm just saying, as that's what sustained us anyway. And you said something, Sheila, as a people and as artists, we have been adaptable, being able to adapt and adjust. And because like Roberta Flack's song, like a willow, we can bend. And that's how we've been able to not only survive, to overcome and to blossom. We're such a fierce people. That's why everybody wants to imitate us. They want everything yes. about other than the skin. And I'll tell you guys one thing. My son was in preschool. He lived in Malibu. And he came home from school and they were teasing him about his beautiful chocolate self. And I said, baby, they're out there turning into lobsters trying to get this beautiful brown you already have. And I could tell it had to have been the parents, because however he articulated it, when he got back to preschool, it was a different ball game. And then, of course, the little girls loved him. And that frightened me, because I said, oh, man, I need to get this baby up out of here, because I don't know. But anyway, we're just so fierce.
You said that we take care of one another. I tell this story wherever I go, is that Starletta used to feed me. We lived around the corner from one another. And like Star said, you can always come over here, and she would feed me. And you hear that and you think, oh, okay, no, I really needed it. And she was always there. You never forget the people who are with you when you really need them. And she was right there. She was always there. She was always there for me. And she knows I just love her to life.
Yeah, see, you, my sister, and Margaret, I'm glad you're here, because I want to get to know you even more and know of all the, your wonderful successes, because we are a family. And this is what we need to pass on to the younger ones. We're yes. never in competition with each other. No. What has our name on it, we're going to no. do. And so no. uplift one another, encourage and encourage the younger ones, because to be in show business is not for the faint of heart. Just straight up.
Margaret, talk about what you're doing today. It's a departure from your show business side, but it's a very important work nonetheless.
The nonprofit arena is one that I found myself, even when I was working with Tammy, working in. There was a guy by the name of Frank Barron that would coordinate all of the major dinners that our nonprofit organizations would hire him to create. And he would always need a chairman of the dinner. And so he would call Sidney Poitier, I want you to be the chairman of this dinner for the USO. Or he'd call Dionne Warwick, I need you to be the chairman. And then they would have to write letters to all these people that they knew to ask them to contribute to the whatever that he was coordinating. So I moonlighted with Frank and learned how he coordinated dinners. So if he's going to ask Sammy to be the chairman and I'm giving him this list of names of people to send the letters to, I've got the list. I may as well do this myself. So I started creating events. And Sheila, you asked me to be one of your hostesses. And I have a picture on the wall here in my house with Mandela and his wife from who coordinated. So I brought back memories of us being together in those days. But working in the nonprofit arena was something that I just happened upon. Eventually, the United Negro College Fund hired me to produce the Lou Ross Greater Stars Telethon for the San Francisco market. And having been in Los Angeles all my life, my mid years in the adult life, I went to San Francisco as a virgin. It was all virgin territory for me. I had never done any fundraising there. But I had friends in Los Angeles that knew people in the Bay Area, and they opened up doors for me to get to the fraternities and sororities and the accounting associations and the teachers associations, because I needed people to answer phones. I needed people to do fundraisers to help us raise money so that we could meet our goals. And we working with the United Negro College Fund was the best experience I had in my life, because I learned how to really work with my people. Generally, the people that I worked with were of the other persuasion. So I got to know my brothers and sisters from all over the United States. I was embarrassed when I would go to make a presentation to some students that we would try to recruit to go to an HBCU, and they say, Miss Margaret, what school did you go to? And I went to Cal State LA.
They don't care where money comes from.
That's right.
As long as they get the money.
Exactly. So I found myself in the nonprofit arena and staying there. These past 22 years, I've been with the California Council for Veterans Affairs, a shelter for homeless female veterans. And I brought people from the industry to the nonprofit arena by inviting them to come when we would have special occasions. Christmas, Beverly Todd would come and help the ladies open their Christmas gifts that had been given to them from some sorority or some nonprofit, other agency that wanted to assist us. I've had, before she passed away, Janae Dubois, and people that I knew personally would come, and the ladies would, they weren't that impressed, but it was just nice to know that my friends would come and support me at this facility and make an impression on the ladies that they are there for them. My granddaughter says she wants to have a nonprofit organization because she's seen the work that I've done. And she says, I can't wait till summer because I'm going to have a lemonade stand and I'm going to raise money so I can help the veterans. 9 years old and she wants to help the veterans.
Can people donate to your organization?
Yes, they can.
Or they do that.
They can just go to embushware@hotmail.com and make a donation through Zelle. We have that kind of situation set up with Bank of America, which is a nonprofit organization. Once the donation is placed in the bank account, I would then send them a thank you letter thanking them for the contribution. So it's Embush.
Can you say it a little bit slower? M for as in Margaret, Bush,
B-U-S-H-W-A-R-E, embushware@hotmail.com, a donation through Zelle.
Do you have a website?
No, we've been working on putting one together for the past year. I got a grant from the Hilton Foundation to create a website. So we're working on that. It should be up by May.
Okay. All right.
I was telling Margaret, she's making me want to examine and look at a different area altogether, nonprofit.
It's something that is very rewarding. I've had women come through the shelter out of all of the different branches of the military, Navy, Army, Air Force, Marines, and they're strong. And I always encourage them to do better. You don't have to be homeless. You can make a life for yourself. And I have professional staff working with them. Staff members that counsel them are LCSWs and MSWs. They are qualified counselors. So they just see me come in. I happen to drive a car that, you know, is nice, and we ask them to save their money. So when they get ready to move into independent living, they'll have a nest egg, something to fall back on. And one lady, she saved up about $35,000 and she was excited. She came to our monthly meeting and she said, Miss Margaret, I'm going down the street to the car lot and buy me a car just like yours. I said, no, don't do that because you don't know if just buying that car doesn't mean anything. You've got to take care of it. And when you take it to the car dealership to get it repaired, it's going to cost more than your monthly payment to get the car set. Just buy, if you've got $35,000, take $5,000 and buy a nice car that can get you to work and forget about what Miss Margaret drives.
Margaret, you didn't really cover when she was in the entertainment industry and she was involved, and whether or not it was nonprofit or her other company, that she always, by inviting the entertainers who didn't necessarily have an acting job at that time, she kept us involved in the mix, because in Hollywood, it's just a small nucleus. You know, it isn't a huge group with a lot of tentacles. And so she kept a lot of us in the mix. And in Los Angeles, if you're not seen, then you're forgotten. So she does. So she did that very well. I just wanted to add that.
Sammy would have a party, or he would have a screening of a movie that had just been released, and I would call the studios and get the film delivered to his house. And I'd say, which group do you want to come? If it was an African-American film, he'd say, the B-list that met all the Blacks.
I really love Sammy. I just got to tell this story. Stephen, can I tell the story? I was Gordon Parks' date for a luncheon. Gordon and I, we were walking up the back steps, and behind us is Gregory Peck, is all of the top famous white actresses, and Gordon and I were the only people of color. color. So when we walk into the bistro, they swoop Gordon away and they pull him away. I don't know anybody. So I'm standing at the door shrinking. I hear this voice across the room, Sheila Frazier. Oh my goodness, Sheila Frazier's here. Everyone, do you see? And it's Sammy. I've never met Sammy before in my life. He came over and he takes my hand and he's introducing me. This is, you don't know Sheila Frazier? Oh, this is Sheila Frazier. This is she. And he treated me from that point on. We were close friends. That was my buddy. So much so that when it was my mother's 60th birthday and my sisters and I flew her to Los Angeles, we said, we're taking you to Las Vegas. I called Sammy, turned it out for her. He had a spread in his suite with the winding stairs and then all the way up in honor of my mother. And my mother was just in heaven. So that's my Sammy Davis story.
Oh, that's beautiful.
That was what impressed me the most about him. He cared about his people. And he wanted to always make sure that everyone was comfortable. We would just be on the road and he would say, oh, this is the city that he lives in. Let's call him up and tell him to come see the show. And it may have been someone that he knew that may have been just like the maid or the person that worked on the elevator when he was a kid growing up. He remembered all those people and from, and he would make sure that they would come to see his show. That's what I loved about Sammy Davis.
He was amazing.
How has Hollywood changed from the time when you all got your start, or has it changed? Has it changed for the better?
It's changed for the better in that we are financing more of our own things. Story-wise and content-wise, maybe I'm old school, but I'm not as excited by it at all.
And I can understand what she's saying too, but what I'm loving now that I can foresee, people really want to know who we are and to hear our stories. And I give you an example. When Taraji P. Henson and Octavia Spencer got the rights to do Hidden Figures, those are my sorority sisters, and I didn't know about them. So I got a chance to know who they were. And John Glenn would not go into space without these brilliant mathematicians. And so what is happening now, like I see somebody's getting ready to do Shirley Chisholm, is that Regina?
Yes, Regina.
Oh, yeah. And see, stuff is changing. What she did with One Night in Miami, this baby is gone. We're getting ready to honor. Marla Gibbs is getting ready to have her star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So we're all chipping in because these stars you have to buy. But this baby, in a point I'm making, she started from 227.
Yeah.
She may be the first woman of color director to win an Oscar and these other awards, and they're getting the story, the rights to these various stories about different women of color or about us as a people and a nation. So I'm very hopeful that this is what's happening, and so I can see change, and hopefully the hip-hop children and the folks in the music business and the athletes, these people that have the stupid money, that they will say, wow, we can finance our own projects. We don't have to wait. As True to the Game is a Terry Woods trilogy. And the producer, he's an independent producer, and he ended up having to be an independent distributor. So we're doing more of that, because I remember back in the 70s when Bill Cosby wanted to actually buy a network and got shut down. So times are changing, and I'm loving that. And I feel that the content, we're going to have comedy. Like, I was very upset when the NAACP knocked Color Purple, but Amos and it was high camp, the Three Stooges and all of those other folk, Abbott and Lou Costello, and they didn't have a job for those actors that they blackballed. They blackballed Color Purple at first. Y'all remember that?
I did not know that.
And that movie is a classic.
That's right.
When you were talking about Amos and Andy, I had many arguments with Curtis Rogers, who was the lead attorney for NAACP, in terms of trying to ban Amos and Andy. Because I said, hey, this is what they were offered at that time. They had to eat. And they had to be able to show how good they were. And it was no different than Honeymooners.
Abbott and Lou Costello, Martin and Lewis, the list goes on. High camp. And it was funny.
Yes, it was. And I still watch it today.
Yeah, I'm going to buy the packet. My birthday is July 18th, and that's Nelson, that's Mandiba's birthday. And I wish to God that I had a chance to meet him. I'm encouraged just by, but I did go to Robben Island and to see where he was imprisoned. And yes. I'm encouraged because if he could overcome all of that, we can overcome anything.
I'm telling you, and that Robben Island, I've been there as well. What I wanted to say, we all stand on their shoulders. Like I used to look at, oh, that was just awful. But then I started thinking, wait a minute. Amos and Andy was one of the most popular shows on that network.
Spencer Williams, who was Andy, who played Andy.
That's right.
One of the most prolific directors.
That's right. That's exactly right.
See?
That is exactly right. Because we didn't see them as businessmen. We saw them as buffoons, but they were smart.
Yes, they were.
Yeah, they were, and all of our children should see it. They should see Stephen Fetcher. They should see
Rochester.
Like you were saying, Star, we are an amazingly rich people. You know, if you think of the decades of racism and coming through the last administration and being target practice for what's going on in the country now, and still we rise. We get up, not that our hearts are not wounded. We keep pushing forward. You watch. We are going to be a force like the country's never seen to be reckoned with. I really believe that.
I see it. I see it. You see the inclusion in terms of commercials, and I just see it because people now are being held accountable for content, and we're bankable.
We cannot relax.
No, we cannot relax. We did that after the 60s into the 70s, and we got low.
That's right.
That's why a lot of our HBCUs are gone by the wayside. And so integration did some wonderful things, but it also did some things that we weren't aware was going to happen.
I want to thank you all so much for being part of this broadcast. Actually, you all's whole story fits into the theme of this show. It's progress despite obstacles. Progress despite obstacles. And it's just what you just said, Starletta. We are resilient people. And I appreciate all of you all taking the time to be on my broadcast today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And have a wonderful evening, day, and be careful and be safe.
Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
The Break Store. Unique branded gifts for the holidays, birthdays, or just because. Visit us at www.thebreakstore.com. Hit the right black get in touch button.